Good morning, this is Carol Ventura, Executive Director of Rhode Island Housing. This is the August 10th meeting of the Rhode Island Housing Board of Commissioners Credit Committee. This meeting is also being conducted telephonically to provide further access by the public. CJ Rotella, the Director of Information Technology for Rhode Island Housing, will provide information on this meeting.
Good morning, this is CJ Rotella. This meeting will be recorded and available for your review on Rhode Island Housing's website within 3 to 5 business days after this meeting. Except for specific Rhode Island Housing staff, all callers will be muted during this meeting. To prevent any feedback or background noise, we ask participant staff to please mute your telephone if you are not speaking. During the meeting, if anyone is having technical difficulties with the audio or accessing the call, they should call 401-457-1240. Thank you.
Thank you, CJ. Corinne Myers, General Counsel for Rhode Island Housing, will provide additional information on this meeting.
Good morning. This is Corinne Myers speaking. Members of the public can visit the RI Housing website to view today's agenda and information on each of the actions being taken. If the teleconference is interrupted, we will stop the meeting until audio can be restored. Chairman of the Credit Committee, Kevin Orth, will preside at today's meeting. Commissioners and staff, please state your name prior to speaking each and every time. Now I will turn it over to Committee Chairman Orth to call the meeting to order.
Thank you, Corinne. This is Committee Chairman Orth. The meeting is now called to order. It is 9:35. Carol, conduct a call, attendance call.
Attendance call, yeah. Commissioner Barry.
Here.
Commissioner Orth.
Here.
Sarah, can you state your name for the record?
Sure. My name is Sarah Cabral, and I'm from CDR.
Thank you. Josh Saul.
Josh Saul, Secretary of Housing.
Here. Thank you. Thank you. We're all set.
Great. Thank you very much. Now I'd like to move to the first agenda item, which is approval of the minutes of the Credit Committee meeting held on June 8, 2022. I believe we might have been the only committee member here at that meeting. Here today.
Don't have the attendance in front of me, Chairman.
Okay. Okay.
Would you like to hold the motion for September?
I think that makes sense.
Okay. We'll pass for now.
So we'll move on to item number 2, which is recommendation for approval of Housing Production Fund Extremely Low Income Operating Reserve, also known as HPF ELI awards. A motion to approve.
Or, I'll move.
And a second.
Second,
great. Any comment, or who's going to, I guess, present this one?
Would you like me to?
Yes.
We'll introduce Michael.
All right.
Thank you, this is Dan Berman. So as we've talked about previously, the Housing Production Fund was established by the state for the planning and production of affordable housing for households in Rhode Island. And it is funded through the real estate transfer tax, but was initially seeded by the legislature for $25 million. $10 million of that has been earmarked for operating assistance to households either exiting homelessness or earning no more than 30% of AMI. The funds will bridge the gap between the residents' ability to pay 30% of their gross household income toward rent and the established 50% low-income housing tax credit rent for the applicable unit size. In March of this year, we issued a request for proposals for HPF ELI funds as part of the consolidated RFP we issued. In response, we received 4 proposals requesting about $2.9 million in HPF ELI funds. Staff from Development and Leased Housing reviewed the applications in accordance with the program review criteria. So of the 4 proposals received, we are recommending 3 awards in the amount of $1,004,880 to support 15 residential units for 10 years. I'm going to turn it over to Mike DeCaro, Director of Leased Housing, who did the heavy lift in terms of the review, and he can outline the 3 projects that we are awarding.
Gotcha.
Thank you, Mike. This is Michael DeCaro. I'm going to go through a summary of funding recommendations. The ELI program. First one is 213 Garden Street. Pawtucket Central Falls Development Corporation is requesting operating support for 2 units in a 6-unit building originally developed in 2007, supporting 400 homeless men. The The property is currently supported by a neighborhood opportunities program escrow that is likely to be depleted in the next 12 to 18 months. The proposed operating expenses are reasonable, and the pro forma reflects positive cash flow for 30 years. Recommendation is made for funding support for $134,160 to support those 2 units and 10 units. Next project is Looking Upwards Apartment. It's a conversion of existing building currently used by Looking Upwards Inc. for stories, offices, and one private commercial tenant who is going to be vacated. Working with SWAP, as their developer, the new development will provide 12 affordable apartments in Jamestown to create independent homes, 8 of which will be designated for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities or at risk of homelessness. We've signed this project, again, to support these 8 units for 10 years and reduce to an award of $510,720. Third project that we're recommending funding for is Forest Farm Assisted Living. This is a 49-unit assisted living facility in Middletown. 35 of the units are currently restricted to households below 60% of AMI, and 30 of the restricted units are supported by a project-based voucher contract, which defers some of the costs associated with the room and board for these units. Forest Farm was refinanced by Renown Housing in December of last year, and at that time it was understood that 5 units were unsubsidized and not able to fully support the meal expenses. The developer, Church Community Housing, has now requested $600 per month to defer the expense of resident meals for these 5 units. The underwriting protections are consistent with the pro forma used in the recently approved transaction from December of last year, and we are recommending funding for $360,000, which will support those units for 10 years.
Great. Thank you very much for that presentation. Any questions? Comments?
Josh Sell here. I have a couple of questions. You mentioned Garden Street has a positive cash flow for the next 30 years. Does that assume a renewal of the operating subsidy beyond 10 years, or how is that 10-year subsidy spread out?
So it's a 6-unit development, 2 units, they've got a project-based voucher contract with the Second Housing Authority, 2 units of self-supporting at 50% AMI, and these 2 units, the 10-year subsidy. Between the combination of the voucher, the regular rent, and continuous subsidy, we anticipate the pro forma projects positive cash flow through 30 years.
Okay. And 2 out of 3 of these are preservation, right? So they're not new construction. Are there marketing guidelines where when there's turnover, there's a priority to house formerly homeless individuals?
I don't think most of these developments, so in the case of Garden Street, they have use restrictions that restrict certain units to 30% of area median income. And in the case of Forest Farm, it's basically those 35 units have to be Medicaid eligible mm-hmm. units, so their incomes are far below 30% of area median income.
So to be clear, yeah. though, the units are not restricted to homeless households, but they are ELI units.
Okay.
All 3 of these developments are permanent supportive housing. We would classify them as permanent.
But that doesn't mean that they're using permanent supportive housing, like continuum of care permanent supportive housing vouchers to pay for.
That's absolutely true, yes.
So they are.
And I'm not aware of any continuum of care dollars in these unless.
No, and if they had the continuum of care dollars, they wouldn't
need
this operating.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is Sarah Cabral. The Forest Farm Assisted Living, that funding is for supporting the meal vouchers of those units. Is that correct?
It is, yeah.
I just want to make sure I'm correct. Okay.
So these units are building upon, you know, what was a neighborhood opportunities program that we discussed, that we've been discussing for a very long time. We continue to have, I think, 343 units still subsidized under the Neighborhood Opportunities Program, and we have a reserve of about $6 million to continue to support these units. So we're now adding units to a pool with a limited subsidy at this point unless the state continues to support these units after year 10.
And Carol, would you say that we have an opportunity to improve upon kind of that similar program?
Tease that out a little bit more for me, what you're asking.
Well, I think that not to steer it in any particular way, but I'm thinking that was, say, an unfunded mandate, if you will, and this one seems to be a 10-year, so hopefully if the money is you know, invested properly and spent according to projections here. Is there, I guess, ideally we would be creating kind of a perpetual fund, maybe using the interest earnings off of that fund to subsidize these units. Obviously, we wouldn't be able to do at this time so many units, but
right, but
something so that we're not facing this cliff again in
so,
10 years. I guess
right.
That's the biggest
right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. NOP was an annual appropriation, right, in the budget. This is part of a real estate transfer tax. Doesn't mean that it's going to inevitably support everything created under the program, but I want to make the board aware that this is, again, a program that has previously, you know, depleted some of its resources. And, you know, the goal is to try to get people into permanent sources of subsidies. So I'm hopeful that the real estate transfer tax will support these units moving forward.
And I would add, this is Ann, that in the case of Garden Street, there used to be 6 NOP units.
Yes.
PC, FTC, to their credit, saw that the NOP was going to expire in 18 months and was able to at least secure project-based vouchers for 2 of the units. So, I mean, it's not perfect, but it's a, you know,
play a transition to more permanent housing.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay. And just another follow-up, and what monitoring will be done to ensure that funds are properly invested and then will be used?
Mike's team will monitor.
So we'll follow the same process we do with NOP now. It's a quarterly reposition. We confirm the tenant's rent, confirm the income, confirm the rent that they're paying, make that calculation between the expenses associated with that unit and the rent that they're paying, and like that.
Okay. Okay, but as you said, this is a 10-year versus annual. Okay.
Yes, 10 years. And NOP was also 10 years, but NOP was created a long time ago. So we did a lot of work probably 3 or 4 years ago to try to encourage people like Linda at PCFTC to try to get their hands on project-based vouchers to ensure some stability among the developments funded. I think there's 53 developments funded with NOC. So important units, right? 343 units of people with 0 to 30% AMI. So it's critical for a lot of folks that need this type of subsidy.
Right. I have one quick question. So I think you might have sort of answered it with that, Carol, but so we had 25 proposals over $19 million, that was the request.
Mike for Ann has to confirm. I don't.
Yeah,
that
was for CMF.
Okay. Oh, okay. Oh, all right.
For this one, we received 4 proposals.
Okay, that's it. Okay.
Which I was very surprised that there weren't more proposals. And I'm not quite sure why. I don't know if it's the sensitivity around the 10-year cliff. I'm not sure why there wasn't more. Maybe we need to do a better job of messaging it and marketing it out there. But I was surprised.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, there were a lot of resources being made available very quickly. I think in our next consolidated plan, we can certainly, you know, we will have additional resources now as well. So we can just make sure that folks are aware. And I think the primary reason is we had 11 vouchers. And most of the applicants in the previous round that awarded funding also received allocations of 8-11 vouchers.
Yeah.
We have now exhausted our 100%.
We fully deployed.
So I'm feeling that the next application will be, you'll see a lot more requests for the HPF ELI, and I wouldn't be surprised if it all got allocated in the next 12 months.
Thank you.
Now
questions or comments? Hearing none?
Josh Saul.
Josh, please.
So thanks. I think, Carol, you're absolutely right, and thank you for presenting this and really undertaking it, that there's a lot of very low-income and extremely low-income households that are especially vulnerable when the market is as tight as it is right now and the vacancies are so low. I did have one more question on the Forest Farm assisted living. It seems like this subsidy is covering or deferring the expenses and meals for these five units. We can follow up on this, but it's more of a legal question as to whether that complies with the legislation, if it's specifically covering those meals as opposed to, and how they're underwritten as expenses versus housing expenses.
They are part of an assisted living budget, so they are expenses around the operation of the unit. So we'll go back and have a discussion about it, but generally I think the Medicaid voucher covers operating expenses that include meals. It's all in. So, but we'll get back to you on that.
So the Medicaid, though, is for the 35 units? Is that right?
I don't know how many.
Or is it?
Yes, so they have Medicaid vouchers for 35 units. They have project-based vouchers for 30 units. The room and board and services is, I don't remember what the number is, but, you know, those units that don't have the
Medicaid
project-based vouchers have to pay the whole nut. So you could say that this was for the rent and not for the and for the board. I mean, but we calculated it as it was just, I think, a simpler calculation.
Right. I think the complicated, we've been starting this for years, the structure of the Medicaid waivers, the resident comes to the home, they retain $100 of their, you know, their other check. Everything else goes to the site to support their room, the board, the meal expenses. So Forest Farms has an arrangement with the nursery center that's attached to their property, and they pay them a fee to provide meals, provide services, provide everything that that person needs to be successful in that unit. When they have the project-based voucher, there's enough rent there to cover the meals without that voucher.
And I think that, Josh, I think that traditionally the Medicaid stipend has been very low in Rhode Island, and folks struggled with assisted livings that have been created over the years to try to keep up with expenses. We've had, you know, assisted living struggle that are in our portfolio, but we'll check into the meal stipend and see whether or not it would conform from a legal perspective.
Yeah, no, it'll be good to understand a little bit more the structure of the deal and how the expenses and the sources match, just to make sure that we can work with partners and other agencies to coordinate that, so we're not just putting housing money to fill the gaps for other things that
for
should
Medicaid
be
filled by. Yeah,
yeah. Medicaid or other
yeah.
services.
I agree, yeah. Yep.
There was a period of time where it just did not increase the Medicaid voucher for 10 years,
yep.
But costs certainly went up.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Corinne, please take a vote.
Yes, this is Corinne Myers. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of Housing Production Fund Extremely Low Income Operating Reserve Awards, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, say nay. For the record, the motion is approved by unanimous vote.
Thank you. I'd like to move on to agenda item 3, which is recommendation for preliminary approval of capital magnet fund awards. Anne, will you be presenting this?
I am. Unfortunately, great. Most of my staff is on vacation this week, so that's with me. So the capital magnet program, or CMF as we like to call it, is funded by the Community Development Financial Institutions Fund, which is an arm of the Department of Treasury. Again, in March 22, we issued our request for proposals for CMF funds as part of a consolidated funding round. Just as an aside, we had received 3 grants at that time, totaling about $15 million, and we had about $1.7 million. We received 25 proposals, requesting almost $19 million in CMF funds. The 4 threshold criteria, which is consistent across all of our funding sources, developer capacity, financial feasibility, readiness, proceed marketability are applied. But in addition, under the CMF assistance agreements, we have very specific metrics we need to meet around certain census tracts and the provision that 40% of the units are for households below 50% of AMI. So it doesn't work for every project. So what we're proposing today is four projects in the amount of $1,776,001 being recommended for preliminary commitment. And I note that there were additional CMF funds that were awarded in June as part of firm commitments to a couple of other projects. So that's, if you subtract that out, that's how we got to the $1.7 million. Each of the commitments is subject to completion of the full capital stack as well as final approval for each project. So I'll quickly run through these four projects that will preserve or build 325 units, 308 of which will be CMF assisted. The first two are Summer Street 1 and Summer Street 2, which is 176 units, which is part of a twinning deal. All of the units will be 30% AMI units. The 9% transaction has 87 units. The 4% transaction has 89 units. Each phase is being allocated $500,000 of CMF. And of course, it's contingent upon standard underwriting and the closing of both of those transactions. Those developments are in the process of sort of completing their capital stack. So this is just part of a capital stack that's about as long as I've ever seen for any deal. The second project is Vernon Mill, which is in Woonsocket, 60 units. Serving households from 30% to 80% of AMI. We are recommending $300,000 of CMF, and this will actually complete their capital stack. Staff is working on underwriting, and we hope to bring that to firm commitment in the next couple of months. The third project is The Avenue. It's a proposed 85-unit development, which will combine 39 mixed-income apartments in a new building on Atwells Avenue, and the preservation of 46 existing affordable units in a development called Elmwood Neighborhood Revitalization 2. So we are recommending $476,001, which will exhaust all of the CMF funding. And this award is actually one of the first commitments to this development. So in total, we're recommending four projects seeking $1,776,000. I will note that after we received all of these awards and had made these decisions, we received another $12 million CMF award. So we will. We're excited to be able to deploy those dollars as well.
Thank you very much, Anne. May I have a motion to approve recommendation for preliminary approval of capital magnet? Second, Beth. Yeah. Thank you very much. Any comments or questions?
So we're celebrating $12 million, but I will say that the Capital Magnet Fund is now attracting a lot of HFAs, right? So we've been successful in four rounds, but now Mass Housing has decided they're interested, and Vermont Housing. So I think it will become more and more competitive, which means we'll have to lean on Baker Tilly to help make us more competitive than our sister agencies, since Senator Reeve was so instrumental in creating this fund. So
surprising that others jumped in early.
Well, it is a bear of an application, and I don't know if I've ever told you this, but we waive our entire administrative fee to get this money. So,
towards the consultant.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, in order to bring this money to Rhode Island. So, in my mind, it was a benefit to us, so I was happy to waive that. It's still a lot of work for Ann and the team members, but Baker knows this industry, and they've helped us be very successful. So.
That's really great.
Question,
Josh, please.
So, for the Avenue, it's two different buildings. What's the connection between the two buildings exactly? Are they like shared? They're in two different neighborhoods, and where are they being financed as one transaction or anticipated to be financed as one transaction?
So under our, do you want to?
No, go right ahead.
So it's actually more than two buildings. ENR 2 is, I'm going to do this off the top of my head, is probably 15 separate buildings. The two will be combined into one single asset entity. We've done this multiple times. And primarily they're doing this is because we don't allow preservation-only transactions under our 9% QAP and in the funding round. So there have been quite a number of CDCs that have taken existing low-income housing tax credit deals that are beyond year 15 and combined them with new construction to be eligible for the 9% funding round.
And if I can just add to that, critical mass provides operating efficiencies. So our tax credit deals tend to be very small deals. And when combined, when you combine two or three together, you have operating efficiencies. So that's why this is an attractive proposal.
And when's the anticipated closing date? Is this going to be closing within 9 months? And what's the commitment date is 2023 is earned? A date that this has to be actually spent by just the CMF?
Yes. So under the entire CMF award, you need to make all of your commitments in the first 2 years. You need to spend your first dollar within 3 years, and you need to expend all of the money within 5 years. So there's no concern that we wouldn't meet that.
Just to follow up on that, one of the threshold items is it needs to proceed to closing and begin construction within 9 months. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I'm cautiously optimistic. So they're also, we're recommending them for some AHT money or preservation money at the AHT board meeting. I think this project will be pretty, they were the sixth highest in the 9% round. They just kind of missed the cutoff. So I think they'll be pretty competitive. We have a lot of resources, so I'm cautiously optimistic either under the 9% or 4% that they'll likely be successful.
Okay.
And you know where this is. This is the vacant lot up on Outwells Avenue. It's right near, is that the blind store?
Church.
It's right near the church, right across the street on the other side of the street from the church, right?
Yeah, it's sort of.
Yeah. It's on the same side as the church, though.
Challenge, but it's.
Heading away here towards the highway.
Heading towards the highway.
Hill.
Yeah, on the left-hand side. It's all cleared.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So this is a great, great opportunity.
Yeah,
yeah it is.
The proposal, there was a for-profit developer who actually brought this as a 9% award as part of a preservation transaction about 6 years ago. It didn't score well at the time. Their option expired. They chose not to extend it. And I believe that one neighborhood actually purchased this piece of land about 18 months ago.
So it sounds like a great project, and with the additional funds that are made available, there should be a 9 month, sounds like a realistic, hopefully, timeline.
Any other questions? Yeah. Hearing none. Corinne, would you please take a vote?
Certainly. This is Corinne speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending preliminary approval of Capital Magnet Fund awards as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, say nay. For the record, the motion is approved by a unanimous vote.
Great. Thank you. We'll now move on to agenda item number 4, recommendation for approval of payment for Georgeville Manor located in Smithfield. We'll be presenting again, I suppose, Ann?
I am. this is Ann Berman. This request for action is for approval of the prepayment of the loan associated with Georgeville Apartments, and it is an administrative action required under our general rules. Affiliates of KCE Property Management are the sole shareholders of the development, which contains 54 affordable apartments in Smithfield. They are all subsidized by a Section 8 contract. The current owner is refinancing with another lender using FHA 223 insured loan program. The proceeds from the refinancing will pay off the existing first mortgage, and we have worked with finance to determine there's no prepayment penalty associated with the loan payoff. The development will still be encumbered by a regulatory agreement, which extends until 2047. The owner and the management company are affiliated entities. No change in management is contemplated. The development received an 88 on their most React score, and they provided a list of capital. So we're recommending this for.
Great, thank you. I have a motion to recommend approval of prepayment for Georgeville Manor.
I recuse myself.
Okay. Thank you. I'll second it. All right, great. Thank you. Any comments or questions about this one? It seems very straightforward.
Administrative.
Yeah. Administrative. Okay. No comments or questions. Then, Corinne, would you please conduct a vote on this motion?
This is Corinne speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of prepayment for Georgiaville Manor and Smithfield, please say aye.
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 Any opposed, say nay, and noting one recusal. For the record, with two affirmative votes, the motion is approved.
Great. Thank you very much. We'll now move on to agenda item 5, which is recommendation for approval of transfer of physical assets for Westfield Loft Apartments located in Providence. Anne, please take it away.
Again, this is also an administrative action. West Elmwood Housing Development Corp., they have requested approval to transfer the limited partnership interest in Westfield Loft from Santander Bank to Hope Renewed Realty Corporation, which is an affiliate of West Elmwood Housing Development. The 15-year compliance period that expired in 2020. The development is unique. It has 22 affordable units and 47 market rate units. It's been very successful in the west end of Providence. The transferee will, of course, assume all existing obligations. Bank of America is the current lender, and the loan matures this year. West Elmwood is actually refinancing the property with Greystone. We do have a second mortgage on the property, a small targeted loan, which will remain in place. Current manager will remain the same. There's no changes contemplated, so we recommend approval of the transfer of the limited partnership interest.
Great, thank you. May I please have a motion to recommend approval of transfer of physical assets for Westfield Loft Apartments in Providence?
Given Bank of America.
You're going to refuse? Okay. Thank you, Beth, and I'll second that. Comments or questions about this item? I've got a question for you. You note that the targeted loans, there will be a targeted loan that's to stay in place. Is there any clause in our targeted loan program, or at least back when this was done, that requires a refinance or a due on sale refinance clause?
I don't know that we ever built those provisions in, but we'll check that, Kevin. We'll take a look at the documents.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I will note there's also a home loan, a lead loan,
yes.
And nature, and not loan, not capital loan.
Yeah.
Capital
a lot of things in place before.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll check, though.
Okay.
We'll check for you.
Any other comments or questions? All right, Corinne, would you please conduct a last one?
Yes, this is Corinne speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of the transfer of physical assets or TPA for Westfield Loft Apartments in Providence, please say aye.
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 Any opposed, say nay. Noting one recusal, with two affirmative votes, the motion is approved.
Thank you very much. We'll now move on to our final agenda item, which is recommendation for approval of the final 2023 qualified allocation plan. And Anne sent this one.
This might take a little bit longer than the PPA. So this is for final approval of our 2023 QAP. As you recall, the draft was approved by the board in June. Since then, we held a 30-day public hearing period. We had a public hearing on July 13th via video conference with about 10 attendees. We also received written comments from three parties. We're going to make a couple of adjustments to the actual RFA. I did notice a couple of inconsistencies. We are recommending a few additional changes to the QAP, which address public comments as well as some comments that we received from the credit committee as part of the approval in June. I'm not going to go through every public comment, but I will sort of highlight particularly the changes. So we had recommended in the draft that we eliminate an absolute cap on current development costs. And we did receive comments both for and against that. Most of our stakeholders and sort of part developers were in favor of the elimination of the total development cost cap. Credit committee asked us to go back and look at that out of concern for sort of cost containment issues. We did go back and look at the Connecticut and Massachusetts QAPs, which sort of have very intentional language about eliminating them because of sort of the volatility in the market. And in fact, Massachusetts basically says right in there, we're going to publish it in 2022. They still haven't published it because it, you know, it's kind of all over the map. We did go back and analyze transactions that have closed. I worked very closely with our design and construction team to look at national data so we can kind of try to understand where costs were. And based on that, and based on sort of comments from the credit committee, we are, the draft of the version that you have does reinstitute the total development cap and ends up increasing it by 10%. So it goes to $429,000 per unit. That is the absolute cap. In response to that, we've also increased the leveraging points associated with overall total development costs to try and incentivize people to stay as far below that as possible. As you know, we have a weighted average that we do based on building type. We've gone back and we've looked at all the building types and adjusted those anywhere from 6% to 12% based on kind of what the market dictated. But this is the sort of the absolute cap net of reserves. If you're over this, then you don't qualify for credit.
I'm sorry, just to interject, do you think it would be better to have discussion after each of these items, or?
Certainly, if you want.
Okay.
Sure.
Any,
right ahead.
Maybe we can jump in after these if anybody has a comment on this particular issue.
I thought it made sense, given.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see.
It's a big number.
Yeah.
I think it's very difficult to figure out exactly where it should be pegged.
Yeah.
And I acknowledge that, and thank you for the effort. It seems to feel about right, and I think that adding points to incentivize to be below that cap is a good measure as well.
I agree. I also think that having it too low decreases
people's
incentive
here. Yes, I agree.
Can't do it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Just with the cost of land, the scarcity of land, and real estate available, the pool of contractors we have, it's challenging just to do what we do every day, never mind another round with
you
more
want people
deals.
To feel like they can at least roll up their sleeves and try to figure it out.
Yes, so. Yes, yeah.
The next thing we did was we added some language regarding hybrid transactions, which seems to be more popular than it used to be. I note that there were two particular issues we wanted to address. The first is that units have to be prorated across the each project or tranche by bedroom size based on the percentage of units in each tranche. So, for example, you can't have all the one bedrooms in one tranche and all the two bedrooms in another. I think it's a much more equitable system, and it I think it's fairer in terms of the overall scoring for a 9% deal. The second specific change that we added to the bulletin, but we've also inserted into the QAP, is that the gap funding request for the transaction has to primarily support the affordable units and not the market rate units. And that's a bit of a judgment call, but because it may not be perfect, but we want to make sure that a disproportionate amount is on the affordable. We've also, so we talked about the increase in efficiency points for overall total development costs from 20 to 25 points, again, to incentivize folks to really pay attention to cost containment issues. We did add points for the creation of three-bedroom or larger units. We know that you know, we need units across all bedroom sizes. We also know that, you know, based on demographics, we hear that family sizes are changing. That being said, for the last 5 years, we've had a disproportionate number of developments with one and two bedroom units, and we know that we have developers with long waiting lists for three bedroom plus units, so we thought it was appropriate to add additional points if you're going to build three bedroom units. I also think that there's, and I don't necessarily have hard evidence, but we know that in a lot of sort of suburban communities, developers will do one and two bedroom units because it's easier. You don't necessarily have to have a conversation with the town about additional kids in the school system, but you know, we know that building in those communities is important for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is sometimes the schools provide an advantage. So we want to make sure that we're incentivizing everybody across all communities to do three bedroom units. And then finally, we, and this is not in the chart, this is one of the corrections we need to make in the actual RSA that you'll see for the board meeting, is we added, well, we made a change to our leveraging calculations. We noticed that developers are willing to take on a little bit more debt, and so they also may also have equity from federal historic credits. So rather than it being $30,000 or more in terms of or $30,000 or less in terms of debt, we've actually created a basically a bigger scale for them to be awarded points in. I don't know if you want me to go through all the comments that we received and the ones that we didn't necessarily make changes for. I think we've explained it pretty well here.
I think you've explained it very well. And if we have particular questions, I think we can raise them.
So,
okay, great. I'll take entertain a motion to recommend approval of the final 2023 qualified allocation plan. So moved by Maria. I'll second it. And now I'll open it for comments or questions. Do you have any others?
I had a quick question. So on the three bedrooms, you did a good job explaining it in the write-up. And did I read that you gave additional points for three bedrooms, but there was a limit on the percentage that could be three bedrooms? Was that right?
I think it was I'll go back and look. I think it's the limit on the number of points that you would get. Right? So if you're over, I think it's 30%, you would get X number of points. If you're at 70%, you'd get the same number of points.
Okay. Yeah, because it's just the reasoning makes sense. It's just I was surprised to see that. I thought I remembered a long time ago there was something the opposite where there was too many three bedrooms and that was going, is that right? Am I remembering
yes.
that correctly?
Yes. Several years ago, this is James Gilmer, several years ago there was some work done where data came out that we were short on the one bedroom side, and so, you know, we adjusted slightly to meet that market need, And now we're just, it's basically, this is why we do the QAP every year, is to see what the needs are, get the feedback, and determine how best we can tailor our policies to meet that.
I mean, at the end of the day, you probably know better than all of us that it's market driven, right? Not every community should have three bedrooms. Not every community should have one bedroom, right? And so, I think if you're doing a 50-unit development and more than 30% of them are three-bedroom units, you got to really prove to me that you need those three-bedroom units. And so I don't think we're going to get a lot that are much more than 10 or 15%. But again, there may be that opportunity where it's very appropriate.
Right. And you'll always base off the market study, which I think is, I 100% agree with that, because I've seen units that were built for different reasons, and then they're not built correctly for what's needed in the market, and that can really create a challenge. So as long as that study is going to be done.
Yeah, and the market changes so rapidly, right? And I know Josh is charged with doing a state housing plan, which is going to look at a lot of this. You know, what do we need for housing? Where are the critical needs in the state? And so that will help inform us moving forward.
Just a question. Is there a formal analysis on the waiting lists and the unit types? I know you talked about it a little bit, but has the board or has Rhode Island Housing conducted that? And
I have not. We, as part of at least the 9% applications, we do require that they provide, they have to show us need. And so for many of our existing developers who have existing portfolios, they will provide a waiting list for those existing portfolios, and it will show us, they have X and 1, this many in 2s, this many in 3s.
Are you referring to project waiting lists or the centralized wait list?
Either one that shows really the need for that type of bedroom mix.
Yeah, I think we do it more on a project level. So the Housing Choice Voucher Program, the centralized wait list for the state, doesn't come into that. I just want to be clear that we're addressing your question.
And are there any other unit size requirements other than incentivizing the 3-plus bedrooms? Can you do like just all studios and then a couple of 3 bedrooms, or how's the?
Nope, we don't have any other requirements. Again, we have a weighted average score that we do, and so the financial leveraging is about 45% of the overall points that you would be awarded under 9%. So most developers sort of think in terms of how they're going to score, and so efficiencies are not very efficient when it comes to scoring, so I don't think you'll see very many efficiencies. I think primarily we're getting 1s and 2s, and we're going to see 1s and 2s and 3s. But again, I don't think you're going to see 3s in every development, right? So
right.
We know we've got a development that's coming in that's for seniors, and it's probably going to be all 1 bedroom.
Well, thank you. We'll definitely be, as we develop a statewide housing plan, working with you and revisiting this, I think, for the next year. And as we go on, just with the demographics and the needs that exist in communities as the market changes as well.
Right. I mean, think about it this way. If you have a single mom, and this is one of the things that we see a lot of, if you have a single mom, she has 2 teenage kids, one's a boy and one's a girl, you need a 3-bedroom apartment. Right? Even though there's only 3 of them. And so there's a fair number of households like that, or, two kids, one sex and one of another. So.
So this scoring system doesn't necessarily take into account for senior type living arrangement. This is more for a family?
No, it's for everyone.
Overall.
Yeah, overall.
No, I was just curious because you said you are going to see some over 55.
Mm-hmm.
So we know.
And that would fall under this type of.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go.
And we financed them in the past.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
a question about the use of gap financing. So I think that, as we've discussed, mixed income projects have a, I think, a very strong public purpose, and we want to encourage them, but not to, say, overly subsidize the market rate units at the expense of the affordable units. And so I'm pleased to see that kind of clarifying language, but it still leaves it maybe a little vague. How would you respond to that? Just so that we can make sure that we're delivering a clear statement to the developer community about what is maybe too much subsidy in a mixed income project. Or
it's a good question, and it's something that I think we've been thinking about. You know, I mean, this is not a perfect science. How much is too much? It's hard to put a number on it, but probably somewhere, you know, we want to see 80 to 85% of it. Again, I'm reticent to put a specific number on it, because you might have a perfect project and it's 2 percentage points one way or another.
Maybe if you have in mind kind of a safe harbor or something like that, we generally want to see it around percent or X dollars or something like that.
I think we can create something for staff to make sure that we're certainly being consistent and that folks are paying attention to the issue.
Okay.
We can certainly also...
We'll circulate something to you, Kevin, to take a look at.
Okay.
Yeah.
One quick question that relates to that question is, so when we say market rate being subsidized, are we talking like workforce, like 80 to 120, or are we actually talking like unrestricted market?
That's a great question, and I think it's
probably a combination.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. You know, sort of not LIHTC is primarily anything over 60%, because we're not seeing much income averaging, at least currently. So I think some of them are sort of that 80 to 100, which we would think of as middle income. I think in certain situations we also have some that are over 120.
Mm-hmm.
My head, I never really thought about the subsidies going for the market rate units. Like, I'm sure it happens. This is the way the numbers work, but I just always thought that the market rate units help subsidize.
That's
and
not
the
what happens where the rent delta is so great, but where the rent delta is not so great.
And we're kind of in that mix where that, unless you're down in Narragansett, even in East Greenwich, the rents aren't that significant. So, yeah, it's challenging and much easier mess than other places. But let's work on a grid, work on something.
Okay.
That we
sounds
can
like it might be trending that way, though, just the way the rents have been increasing, which is another. I think to your point, that's a great question. If we're any of the upside on the market units, if that's recaptured after the deal closes in year five, whatever it might be, to pay down some of the other debt, that's something to consider as well, just on these deals, if they are unrestricted.
Yeah, I mean, all of our soft money, basically 50% of the cash flow goes to pay kind of the waterfall. So, truth be told, I mean, and Mike can comment on this better than I, there's not a lot of cash flow that comes out of these, even the ones with market rate units. Right, we require 115 debt service coverage. We're thrilled when these things operate better than we thought, but we also know that market rents, we've seen certainly a leveling off of them. Are they going to drop? I don't know. There is still a housing shortage, but, with rates going up, there's a different kind of pressures than there were last year.
It'll be interesting to see, just given
any other comments or questions?
Just wanted to talk you through next steps, right? Approved by the board, posted. Corey, you correct me if I go off track, posted.
Mm-hmm.
for comment, and then it will go over to the governor for signature, and we route that through the governor's legal.
I don't think we've come to it yet. Which is, if once it's approved by the board, it goes to the governor.
Goes to the governor directly?
That's right.
Excellent.
Yeah. It's a
okay.
And our
wonderful.
Goal is to issue the consolidated RFP for all the sources that we have, you know, on or about October 1st.
Great.
Great. Okay. So this is our final say-so on this.
Well, go to the board. Go to the board.
Kevin, you can say so anytime. You
this will be the last one. Your say-so will be heard.
And we are going to make a couple of corrections, and I apologize that we missed.
Okay. Okay. Great. Thank you very much, Corinne. Please take a vote on this item.
Of course. This is Corinne Myers. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of the final 2023 qualified allocation plan as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, say nay. The motion is approved with unanimous consent.
Thank you. That concludes our agenda items. We'll move on now to discussion.
I'm kind of repeating what I said last month. You know, we approved so much between May and June. Staff is working really hard to sort of push those developments through the pipeline. We are very excited that the change in the Treasury guidance that came out on how we can use SLRF money with low-income housing tax credits has been a real, like, I don't think I've ever been so excited with news from the Treasury. So that has really simplified our lives. We're working with council we had council working on draft documents about how to do these blended loans. We've now got them working on how they do these new rebound loans. We should be closing our first loan with rebounds by the end of August, fingers crossed. Several of those transactions that were approved in April, May, and June have firm commitment already, so they're in closing. Others have just preliminary. So I would say over the next 6 months, you're going to see a ramp up of deals coming for firm commitment and, you know, closings over the next, you know, say 3 to 9 months and to really clear out that pipeline. So there's about 20 developments, a blend of new construction and preservation. It's about 1,700 units altogether. So.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, so we did close a couple of refinance, Section 8 refinance deals last month. The FFB rate has been holding steady, which is, you know, fingers crossed, great for us. So it's allowed those developments to sort of move forward. We all were kind of holding our breath when interest rates started to jump, but the FFB is doing a really nice job of holding those pretty steady.
Any impact due to the rising construction costs and supply issues? Are you getting feedback from the developer community on that?
Every day. you know, we have deals where in June, you know, I mean, in our mind, they're fully funded. And they're working really hard to make sure that they don't come back and ask for more money. You know, one day lumber goes down, but
aluminum goes up,
or roof, anything with oil, you know, roofing materials went up. So they're working hard, a lot of value engineering going on.
Do you see any significant fall off or plans being abandoned, or is it just reworking your deals to get them?
Yeah. No, for the most part, it's fine-tuning deals. It's not, nobody's abandoning any projects, nobody's backing out on any commitments.
That's not wood.
This is what we got in this day and age. I think, you know, as we move forward, what I think will cause some pressure is the number of contractors and subcontractors. That's going to tighten things up. As we are pushing more deals through than we have in the past, that's going to be a challenge for us to make sure that that's balanced and that they can be absorbed by the market.
Yeah.
Timing might have helped as well with these deals because rates, you know, when you have 5 times, you already have that construction Costco, and when your rates are rising, a lot of the deals that were sized like last year, or even in the early fourth quarter, those ones are seeing huge gaps.
I think the rise in interest rates is definitely going to have an impact on some people. So you'll see probably higher deferred fees. You know, for these deals, if they were got preliminary approval in June, maybe they get firm approval December or January. We don't know where rates are going to be. And, the permanent loan doesn't come for 24 months, right? So then you're talking, it's hard to believe, 2024, 2025. We have no idea what the market's going to look like then. So it's a bit of a guess.
Yeah. Hoping investors stay engaged and interested in Rhode Island and mm-hmm. in our deals. So that's important. We did have HUD release its procurement for PBCA, so that's going to be a major focus for us over the next several months on how we maintain that contract in Rhode Island. Just another challenge to ask.
I will say that LIHTC pricing seems to be holding pretty steady. And in a couple instances, developers who have strong relationships with syndicators have gotten higher pricing than they originally forecasted. So we're hopeful that that will continue. I don't know if you've seen anything in your world that would inform, any changes that we should anticipate.
No, I agree. I think this year it's holding well. I think next year could be question mark from what I'm hearing in the market a little bit, but this year is fine. I do think what we're seeing is more construction costs, having enough cushion in the deal, and then interest rates, based on the interest rates are on the forecast, it's a bigger number than mm-hmm. was before. And so trying to balance, do you have any cushion in that? It's bigger deals, it even gets harder. I have seen several states have to issue more tax credits for gap financing because so many deals, at some point developers can't do it for free, and nor should they, right? You should get a fee out of it. So I've definitely seen a handful of states that have had to go back and issue more tax credits to close the gap.
Yep. How
much your questions?
Good. Sounds like we're just doing a great job in general, so thank you, Anne. I know there's so many projects that the team is working on to get these closed, and it's really a paradigm shift of as we move forward with the additional funding over the next rounds, going from just filling the last million or two and trying to understand long-term planning where the pipeline is will be extremely important.
Yeah, no, I... Staff is doing a great job, working really hard, and I think paying attention to the things that are important.
Thank you.
Do you anything for the rest? Yeah, and I will tag team it, for you. Yeah. Okay, so took an awful lot of work to pull together the fiscal year 23 budget. We're going to go over a few of these documents. You have your summary memo. Page 3 is summary revenue and expenses. Then we go into our program budget. A few charts. And finally, the company-wide expenses on page 9. Big picture for the agency, we still, we expect that our operations will remain stable, even with reduction in the single-family volume. Our operating expenses will be slightly higher than what we budgeted in 22, but below our 22 forecast. Administrative expenses to state and COVID-related programs are going to be a large driver of our operating expenses, adding staff and technology. And I think the initial investment and ongoing maintenance of technology always has an impact on our budget. It's a big part of what we do here at the agency. We expect that lack of investment demand will negatively impact our loan sales, so we'll rely more heavily on the bond market for our single family lending. We're projecting a drop of volume of about 17%.
17%.
I believe, though, that the infusion of federal dollars coming into the agency will allow us to increase production and preservation in the multifamily area, which is a plus, right, resulting in higher fee income in the development group. There is, in the governor's budget, a $30 million allocation for down payment assistance, so we'll provide grants of $17,500, so hopefully that drives more ability for our typical home buyer to purchase this market. We project net income of $5.3 million, which is a decrease, as I mentioned. Fiscal year 22 was a very good year for us with forecasted net income of almost $10 million, which of course helps our ratio. I know you're always focused on that. Net interest income is projected to be down slightly due to bond issuance costs. Single family production is estimated at around $420 million, the greatest amount of volume for tax financing. It also impacts our which will be down due to reliance upon. Our fee income is budgeted at $28 million, much less than $28 million related to our administration of federal programs. We expect to close out the rent relief program, but continue to onboard the programs that were in the governor's budget. The income that we're showing is reimbursement, primarily reimbursement for our operating expenses. This fiscal year, we've been able to reduce our contribution to the loan loss reserve. We feel confident. Kara, we have about, what, $46 million in the loss reserve, so we think it's adequate to cover our first mortgages. So we'll add $1 million for our secondary mortgages, like our down payment assistance. On pages 4 and 5, we've outlined the various programs we're proposing to fund $2.7 million of agency operating dollars. They're familiar to you. They include rental assistance programs, some that we've inherited from the state, LIST Neighborhood Development Fund, the community development program that we've funded for the past, I think, 3 or 4 years, and down payment assistance for non-MRB home buyers. Also, the ZEOS program that we partner with OER on, that's been very successful. I think we've financed over 130 units, I think maybe 138. And lastly, we budgeted operating expenses for the agency at $49.8 million, an increase, of course, over 22 budget. Operating expenses, again, will go down as we wind down rent relief and the homeowner assistance fund, which both programs remain fairly heavily staffed. I think we have 25 temps right now, at least our temporary. So we've provided a few charts comparing our revenue and expenses annually from 2019. On page 6, you can see that our fee income represents the largest revenue. On page 7, you can see in operating expenses over time. And on page 8, we provided price charts on our revenue and expense by division. Josh, I believe we sent you over the numbers you correct. So you can see that development is driving our revenue, and you know, we're fairly evenly expensed across the major operating divisions. We are proposing a 3.5% merit increase. Temporary help will continue to remain high. And of course, we always budget for increases in our benefits area, healthcare costs, dental costs. You'll note large expense reductions in advertising, consulting, and outside services, wind down primarily and our IT group also reclassified some expenses to better align with expense categories. So I breezed through that, and I know you received it, but it'll be presented at the board meeting. Kara, anything you want to add on, sir, on the operations side?
No, I think you covered things very well. I would say I did look at the changes without these new federal grants just to see where we would have been. And it's very small changes in revenue. Admin fee went off 1.1%, so very consistent. In the, on the expense side, we are up 7%, and that's primarily in IT, merit increase, and those types of expenses, and inflation, obviously.
We had a big initiative in Mike in Ann's area with the ProLink platform, so they're still working through that, but it was not an inexpensive endeavor to undertake. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. This is a lot to digest.
I know. I know it is. This is why, well, you have it now, and you have
right.
a week until we go into the board meeting, so you can have your questions all ready for me.
Okay.
When I sit down at the
okay.
table.
Any initial questions on this issue?
I think you touched on it. The outside services that included that big change was from no longer doing
rent relief. You know, we used a lot of outside contractors, some of the people on the ground to help us engage with people to enroll in the program. So those are winding
so
out the contract.
Down, and that's why that is enlarged.
Yeah. And Josh had the benefit of a one-on-one on the budget, so.
Yeah. Thank you, Carol. I just think in general for the board meeting, it would be good to get an understanding of how the budget really aligns with the strategic plan overall that was released and how the priorities moving forward. And just, you know, like broadly speaking, it would be good for the board to understand that.
Okay.
Be helpful. And then just on a related note, how the state's investment in housing, the interaction, I know we've talked about this, but just keeping in mind how that affects the budget and how, in terms of that strategic plan, like seeing it as a whole, right? Because given that the state is putting $250 million over the next years, how is that helping with the strategic plan and versus this budget, and how the two really are working together.
I think that you have shown at least the use. We have limited discretionary funding.
Yeah.
And so we've shown some of the priorities, I think, in this one handout, the program budget, to give us, divvies up to at least $7 million.
Yeah.
Projected 5 million.
Yeah, I think we have more flexibility with us. The operating dollars and our program state, they have to continue to support it. So
yeah.
through our
right.
dollars.
Right.
Yeah.
Looking at this, so the expenses are slated to rise. Operating expenses.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I'm looking at this, and it shows that expenses have gone down. Is that?
You are. I think you're looking at budget to budget, probably.
Oh, this is budget to budget, and this is budget to actual.
That is both budget to actual and budget to budget. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the budget last year included the rent relief and HAF program at a higher dollar amount. So there was $9 million worth of federal programs in last year's admin budget and in the related fees. And this year it's $7 million.
Okay.
And that's primarily in the personnel line, in the outside services.
Outside,
line,
right.
A little bit in the software changes as well.
So just big picture. Why would our expenses be going up in a time maybe when it seems like activity should be going down?
Onboarding additional staff, right? So additional staff to run all of the programs that are coming over from the state.
Okay.
Temporary staff that we're hiring, which is fairly expensive to hire temporary staff.
Sure.
To do the homeowner assistance fund, even though we're winding down rent relief. And I think investment in technology, I mean, you know, for the homeowner assistance fund and also for just operations on the inside, rent relief RI, we also had higher investments in technology.
Okay, yeah, that's a big one, software at $4.2 million. And what is that generally?
Lisa, you can speak to it better than us.
Usually it's in about the $2 million range, but with the Yardi expense in there, which was related to rent relief, that was a significant increase, and also the introduction of the ProLink software that we're implementing right now, which is the development and asset management software.
Okay. So there's still rent relief software expenses to be paid?
Yes, that will be ongoing.
Ongoing for how long?
Well, through the end of December, you know, we expect to have paid out the rest of the rent relief. There will be probably a small fee going forward to retain the data, but it would be, you know, very small.
Okay. And then personnel is slated to go up about 8% or so over?
Yeah. 3%, yeah.
And most of that will be additional personnel, not pay increase.
Well, it's a 3.5%
right.
Merit increase. We are proposing 4 additional FTEs with the action for this budget, so you'll see that as part of the overall.
Oh, just 4?
4 additional staff that we're onboarding, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And, Kara, we don't include temporary staff in this, do we?
It's got its own line item for temporary staff, so it's the third line down. So there's where most of the federal grant staff are listed as temporary staff.
And is that an increase in the number of temporary staff,
it
or
is.
Just their expense has gone up?
Yeah, it's an increase in the
number.
And we have, and correct me, Kara, if I'm saying this wrong. We have varying levels of temporary staff, right? So we have temp staff that come in from a temp agency that, again, it's expensive. And then we've had temporary staff, for lack of a better word, that are working on timed grants, right? Grants that are going to expire after a period of 2 to 3 years, right? So there's varying levels, but there are permanent staff that receive our health care and our benefits. So there's varying degrees of that.
Okay. It's just another question on staffing. I know in my own business it's been exceedingly hard to attract new staff, and we're just short staff almost perpetually.
Yeah.
And existing staff being lured away to other companies and having to, you know, be competitive in their compensation in order to keep them, you know, they're otherwise happy. So what, 3.5%, and I know this looks to a larger state issue too, not just, but is that going to keep us competitive and keep our staff happy and retained?
So we do look at that,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We just completed a compensation study recently, so we did a significant adjustment to some staff that were what we considered not being paid market values. So that was just done over the course of the last year, and then this 3.5% merit increase would be on top of that.
Okay.
And James, you wanted to?
Yeah, no, I think certainly we're on top of the salary piece, and we do look at folks where they are in terms of retention. If they're towards the lower end of a salary scale, and they, you know, we can make an adjustment within that. But also, I think one of the things that makes us very competitive in terms of attracting and retaining staff is the hybrid work environment. It is something, you know, we had kind of the mixed blessing of having to do some important hires during COVID, and we had the benefit of working with an outside search firm, and they gave us some really good feedback about the market. Particularly for HFAs, because they work with a lot of HFAs, and said that we would be non-competitive if we weren't in a hybrid situation, that that's where the industry is moving, that's sort of where everyone is moving, you know, across industries, and that looking forward to attract and retain people, that kind of flexibility is going to be something that's critical. So
it's
great.
And it's amazing how we all differ across the country. So there are many HFAs that you're 100% in office. See a lot of that. And then Mass Housing has closed their doors. Everybody works remotely every week. So it's, I think we have a nice balance of engaging with folks in the office and then allowing them some flexibility to be at home a couple of days a week. And I don't think our turnover rate is huge in the agency. I don't even know if
we're
tracking
it. I think we go through spurts of it.
Yeah.
Right now it's not been huge, and we also have a really good applicant pool coming in for
Do you
use any kind of research companies, or do you just generally get a good applicant pool that comes in?
We do everything we need to do, so if we're not getting a good applicant pool, we'll go out.
I find that with working with the state, going out to Rhode Island College, we're going out to URI, different things like that to try and look, because as you said, the state agencies is very difficult finding employees as well.
And we also find a lot of word of mouth, people that really love working here, and you know, they help us recruit people as well.
Great. I don't have any other questions at this point.
I don't have any
at this
point. I haven't been able to.
I know.
Okay, well, we look forward to a discussion at the board meeting.
Adjourn today's meeting, please.
Second.
All those in favor of adjourning the meeting, say aye.
Aye.
Great. Thank you, everyone.